Okay, well, let's start out review briefly what we covered last time. So I'll leave it to you guys to start off. Anyone want to summarize some of the most significant thoughts from last time? Where we talked about doing the questions, we're looking at it. Questions we need to be ready to answer and ask under three designations. Where did you hear that? Where's the source of the information? How do you know that's true, what, regardless of the source? And then why does it matter? And so yesterday, or last week, we talked about where did you hear that? And so we talked about the Bible. Anyone have any of the more significant thoughts that stood out? Anything? What did we say about the Bible? That it's not just one book, right? It is in one sense, but it's a collection. Anything else?
44 books, 1,500 years.
Yep. 30-something authors. Yep. So keeping that in mind, it's written over a wider period of time. There you go. That was the big part. And how do we do translation? You guys know? Is it a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy? Right. Right. We're going back to early sources, early documents. So those are things that a lot of people don't know, and we need to be prepared for. And so with what we talked about, it was at least an introduction to how do we know we can trust that what we have from 2,000 years, or what, you know, what they wrote 2,000 years ago is what we have today. But then we turn to the next question, which is, so does that mean Christianity is true just because we have the documents passed through history properly, with integrity? Does that mean Christianity is automatically true just because we have exactly what they wrote 2,000 years ago? No. Right? Because then all that you'd have to do to have a true religion would be to have a book that's really old that you know has been passed through history.
Oh, I know somebody else who
has one of those. Exactly, right. Okay. So what else do we need to do? What else do we need in order to know that Christianity is true? So we have the documents that they wrote. Okay, it needs to be historically verified. So we have the documents that, you know, the Old Testament prophets or that Peter or Paul or James, right? We have what they wrote, but now the real question is what they wrote true, right? So it's true that they wrote it. We've established that. Now, is it true what they wrote? And that's what we're turning to, okay? So that's our main point of focus today, is how could we know that it's true? What reasons do we have to believe it? Can we historically verify it? Like what Doug was saying. Okay, so think of some other religions, any that you could think of is fine, and how they started, any outside of Christianity. Just name off anything you know. A religion and what its kind of foundation, what its beginning is based on. Okay, Mormonism, a special word, right? Joseph Smith. Joseph Smith had Jesus and God the Father appear to him in the forest. Then he had an angel come to him, different things like that. Okay, another religion.
Buddhism,
okay. Do you know how Buddhism started? Yeah, Buddha, writings of, right, wisdom type writings. Okay, long time ago. I don't know as much about all the historical background, but I do know that they're pretty much just writings from this guy, although I think there's actually, don't quote me on this, but I think there's actually a little bit of exactly what came from him, and I'm not sure they know exactly that.
So who was Siddhartha?
Siddhartha, yeah. So that's right. Who is? I don't know enough about that to speak to it, other than that that's related. Certainly Siddhartha is part of the background behind that. Yeah, Siddhartha Gautama Buddha. The Buddha. Yeah, do you know when his life was? It was, I'll look it up here quick. It was BCE.
Public schools assigned the book
Yeah, pretty much every public school student will read Siddhartha, I'm guessing. So, just right after they read the New Testament, right? 567 BC. So I was thinking it was going to be 400 or 500, but it's actually a little further back. So, 567. Yep. Right. Born. Yep. Yep. So it's part of the Hindu. So it comes out of Hinduism. So, but what is it based on? It's really based on him, right? And his writings and teachings. It's not really historical, other than it has a historical context. So it's more of just a set of teachings based in a religion that was different. Okay.
What about Hinduism?
Right. Yes. So then that comes from a variety of different sources. Again, I don't know as much about that one, but you've got the Bhagavad Gita or the Vedas, right? And there's different writings that kind of came together. So, but is it based on a historical event? Is it something? Yeah. Or is it just a collection of teachings? It kind of comes back to that.
One of their gods is sort of half pretty woman and half elephant.
Yes, so they have gods of, well, they have lots of gods, lots and lots and lots of gods. You can kind of add unlimited number almost, right? Okay, what about other religions?
Shamanism?
How does that start? Okay, go ahead. Yeah, I don't know as well. Right, in some of these, right, are sort of, yes, right. So, exactly. And there's going to be all kinds of different flavors of animism. And then there's going to be other religions that will mix a little animism in. We'll get syncretism. Okay, what about... Right, oral tradition and passed down. Okay, Islam. Was around them, yeah, and had, so he had, so Islam was started by Muhammad, right, but he was in a cave and had angel appear to him. Right, and so it's the things he supposedly was told by the angel in the cave, and then also other sayings and things from his life that come about, and it's a little unclear exactly when all that started. It doesn't have a very unified form till much, much, much later. So, okay, so but again, what's the similarities between Joseph Smith and Muhammad? They're historically, what? Yeah, an angel came to him. Is what happened to them, was it public? Were there hundreds of people who saw it? Right, no eyewitnesses, except for themselves. Which, if you see something, you're an eyewitness. The question is, how do we verify that? Okay. So thinking of something specifically like some of the other major religions, being Islam, Mormonism, that are more prevalent today, what is the distinction that you'd see between how they started and how Christianity started? Sure. Ah, so that's, I know how I would answer that, but that's going to vary. So the question for anyone who didn't hear and for the recording was, Paul asked, with Joseph Smith and Muhammad, do we not believe that what they say happened, or do we believe they had the experience, but it's just not what they say it was? I would trend much more to the latter. I have no doubt that I have little doubt that they had some sort of experience. In fact, we know this even more from Muhammad because, I don't know if you guys know this, but at first Muhammad thought it was a demon. And it was actually his wife, Khadija, is that how it's said, that convinced him, no, this is from God, you need to listen. Yeah, right. But no, he really thought at first, as I understand it, he was actually afraid and thought it was a demon and then continued. I don't know. I don't know where they came from.
Third option,
Mm-hmm. Right, right, exactly. That's what we're trying to say. Right. Exactly, yeah, yeah. So he's just saying that it's not a matter of if it did. It's one, did or didn't it not happen? And then two, if it happened, what is the source? Is it from God or is it from something else? That's where I would say, right, I agree it probably did happen and it probably was more demonic in nature and influence than from God. Sure. Right. So he's offering another alternative of a hallucination. You could see that probably more in an isolated incident or if something under the same conditions, something as extensive and regular as what supposedly Muhammad or Joseph Smith had was probably something more.
It could
never so in depth. So it could be something where it started there and then maybe they get into it, because it seems what I would be more comfortable saying is that it does seem like Joseph Smith then, I know more about that one, started to intentionally kind of do things. Whatever started influencing him and whatever inspired him in the beginning, I think he started to operate more independently or just very more intentionally as he's creating the new religious works. Because I don't know if you guys know this, but so you'll read the Book of Mormon, they'll come to your door and that's what they want to read. But if you read the Book of Mormon, it's pretty much Trinitarian. There's no, it's odd. It's kind of repetitive and redundant and boring to read. It's weird in that it talks about this whole history of these people in North America that lived amongst the Native Americans, but, you know, weren't. And so that's odd. But if you would say, okay, I just want to do a theological examination of this, you actually don't find too much that's problematic at all. The biggest thing is actually, and I think it's in 2 Nephi, I don't remember the exact chapter, but 10 or something like that. But it talks about the fall, and it talks about how in order to, that essentially Adam and Eve had to fall because they had to know evil in order to know good. And so it was actually better that they fell, because if they hadn't have fallen, they wouldn't know what good is. They just would have existed, and that would have been it. And so they had to fall. I think it says something almost exactly that. But that they might know good, they had to know evil. So you could know evil without knowing good, but you couldn't know good without knowing evil, which I would say that's completely philosophically flip-flopped. That in order to know what evil is, you have to know good first. That evil is a privation or a depredation of good. So you can have good on its own, you can't have evil on its own. And so anyway, so that's the most aberrant thing as far as I'm aware. In the Book of Mormon. Now, you do find some weird things, like a guy talking after he gets his head chopped off, or, you know, weird things like that that just seem like inconsistencies, but you're not going to find major theological problems. Jesus accepts worship. There's a Trinitarian view. You just don't find much. Now, it's in the later works that the more aberrant teaching starts to come in. So if you would say, okay, well, tell me, what is the unique teaching that's different from historic Christianity in the Book of Mormon? If you're talking to an astute Mormon, they would recognize that there's not very much, if anything, other than, again, that there's these people that got sent over from Israel to North America a long time ago. Yeah. Numerous eyewitnesses. Yes. Right, right. So he's making the distinction that between the New Testament and writings and something like Mormonism or Islam, that there's hundreds of eyewitnesses, right? And that's really, really significant, because you're taking it with Mormonism or with Islam, you're really functioning on the private experience of the individual, where, again, I'm not going to say that that wouldn't be historical. If it happened, it's historical, right? In that it actually happened in history. And we're even granting, I think for the most part here, we're probably all on the same page, that we're even granting Joseph Smith might have actually had something appear to him, and that that's historical. What we're questioning is, was it God? Did it happen exactly the way it is, and what happened from there? And there's not a way to corroborate Joseph Smith obviously has some idea that you have to have some sort of corroboration. So he has the plates and he has the people, the signatures at the beginning. If you see, there's the 3 and then the 12 that sign and say they saw. Well, none of them actually ever saw the gold plates. They just felt them over like through a cloth. And even then, well, let's say you chiseled out some plates. Well, that still doesn't mean that everything else you said about them is true. Okay, and then you could get into all kinds of background as to what was going on at the time. It was a time with a lot of folklore, a lot of looking for treasures and using these sort of magic, mystical, like the idea of spyglassing, where you'd put certain magic objects in a hat and look, and then you'd get this insight into where certain things were hidden. And he had actually gotten in trouble, I think had jail time for claiming he could find lost objects and then whatever, being found to be a fraud. So there's some conditions there, but there's not anyone else to there weren't 20 people who saw the vision or who saw God the Father and Jesus Christ in the woods. It was just one. So again, if that happened, it's historical, but how do we establish it as historical? That becomes the big challenge. Uh-huh. Right. Yep. So that's why what's important about what we did last week is, in order to even be able to discuss the eyewitness testimony, as he's bringing up, and to talk about that, we have to know that we actually have eyewitness testimony, which means if the New Testament books are predominantly written from people who saw and are eyewitness testimony of what Jesus taught, what he did, and that he died and was raised, if that's what they are, is eyewitness testimonies, well, that's great. But you first have to say, okay, well, even if it was eyewitness testimony, do we have what they wrote 2,000 years ago? That's step one. Once we know we have what they wrote, now we can analyze, do we believe them? Are they trustworthy? In the same way that we could do this, and again, these aren't only for us to be ready as Christians to answer, they're for us to ask, but then we should be expecting and even encouraging people to think along these lines. Because if you do this, then as you establish these things, you get to the point where you really are just analyzing, am I ready to believe this and submit to it? It's not the questions as to the integrity of it and those types of things can go away. And so that's what we're trying to move to. And that's the progression. And so what would you say, again, from any experience you know of other religions and how they're founded, how they start, how they go, and the first people, what are some distinctions that you see with the New Testament? What's maybe unique about the New Testament writers? Yeah, that's a big one. They do not often portray themselves in the best light, and sometimes quite foolishly, and especially if we think about culturally, sometimes extremely foolishly, with women or with Gentiles being elevated above Jews. I think of with the Roman centurion and Jesus' interaction with the Roman centurion, and that he says, I tell you, with no one in Israel have I found such faith. For I tell you, many will come from east to west and recline at the table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, while the sons of the kingdom will be cast into outer darkness, where there will be a weeping and gnashing of teeth. Right? So think about trying to sell that story to first century Jews who are despised the Roman government, the Romans for occupying, right? Their conception of the Messiah most likely, almost exclusively, with very rare exception, if any, is that the Messiah will come and drive the Romans out and establish the Jews on the top. They don't like not only the Romans, but they don't like any Gentiles, even that are closer to them, that are Semitic peoples, right? And so there's that environment, and then Jesus says this and elevates this Roman centurion who's not only a Roman but is representative of the forces that are occupying, controlling their area, and says that this man has more faith than anyone in Israel, any of the Jews, and that this kind of guy is going to be sitting with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, while all of you, Pharisees especially, are going to be cast in outer darkness. Like that statement. Yeah, exactly. How'd it get by the editors? That statement is so repulsive. It's so ridiculous. The only way you could include that is if it's actually true and there were people who saw it, right? That's, you don't put that in there. You don't put Jesus having the interactions with women in the way you would. This is maybe what's happening when the Syrophoenician woman is needing, is asking for Jesus to heal her daughter, and they're making a big fuss. And the disciples are saying, send her away. She's getting us, essentially, I sort of paraphrasing it, I think they're saying, hey, we're going to get a bad rap with the Jews here if we keep letting this Gentile woman walk with us and cause this fuss. Get rid of her. She's bad publicity. And instead, Jesus, you know, has the interaction with her and highlights her faith.
Peter and his several weaknesses.
Yep, Peter. Right. Peter, who's the champion, who's the greatest, is also a total fool and ignorant. And think about both the Syrophoenician woman, this is pretty interesting, and the Roman centurion. They seem to have a better understanding of who Jesus is than his own disciples, let alone the Jews who are following and sincere, let alone the Pharisees, right? So there's these layers. And here are these two Gentiles who actually seem to recognize who Jesus is better, because the Syrophoenician woman thinks that even a crumb of what Jesus has to offer is enough to drive this from her daughter, to heal her daughter. And the Roman centurion also says that he has so much authority that all he has to do is essentially will that the servant would be healed, and he'll be healed. So they seem to recognize that either Jesus is God, or at least he has the power of God. When Jesus continually is trying to show the disciples and you know, prompting them, and who do you say that I am? And, well, they're this. But they're like, they're getting closer and closer, but they're still not there. And then here are these Gentiles who seemingly had very little interaction, obviously knew enough to have idea, but they just saw what he's doing and pretty much put it together. Okay, well, here's the things he does. Well, there's only one person who can do that. So he's God, or at least has the power of God.
You can address this now if you care to, or
we can go a lot of different directions, so.
It's interesting to consider why it might be that the Jews were slow on getting it, while Gentiles did. What was standing in their way?
Yeah, so he's asking what was standing in the way. Why did the Jews have such a hard time getting it? My main guess would be that the assumptions about the Messiah and what the Messiah was to do, that was so sort of inculcated, that it was such a common view, that anything outside of that was going to be hard for them to grasp. And then think about what is one of the most prevalent, most common committed sayings that the Jews were going to be stuck on. Right? Think of it, and it's a really good one, and we believe it, but think of how the confusion would come. That, behold, our Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one, right? So in their heads, like, that's just not going to, it's not going to be an easy mash, because, well, you can't, this guy can't be God because there's not two gods, right? The understanding of the Trinity would have been absent, even though there might be some references indirectly, or maybe even more directly, to the Trinity in the Old Testament. We wouldn't get them unless you have the idea of the Trinity, right? It's a mystery even with what we have now, but even more so thinking of what was in the Old Testament, right? That wouldn't have been there. Now, Jesus is also clearly saying that there's only one God. He's just sort of equating himself with them, so he's getting there. But maybe that's why. Maybe the Gentiles were a little more open to it because they weren't going to get us stuck on that, so that could have been a reason. But certainly they recognized Jesus' authority more clearly than even the disciples. Oh, I don't know. Paul's asking if we would be sitting here today if the Jews had gotten it when Jesus was on earth. Well, it was, whether it was part of the plan and that's the way it had to happen, or it's just the way it did, and God knew, obviously, knows all things at all times. But, I don't know. It certainly is a relevant part of the story. It fits with Israel kind of wandering from God or wanting kind of their version of what God is going to give them and then kind of coming back to faithfulness. And there are many Christians who believe that there will be a time when many, many Jews in mass will be redeemed and will get it towards the culmination of history. So that's there. But yeah, I think we're on the right track. There's embarrassing details, and there's lots we could go into. There's things you just wouldn't include. I think there's a lot of the things Jesus says and does that you wouldn't include if you're making it up. You could make up a whole lot better story that you would think would sell better. And yet, obviously, it did work. And initially, the church growth was almost exclusively among the Jews. So the early church grew largely and predominantly out of a Jewish population, even in places outside of Jerusalem, in the diaspora, there still was the growth initially amongst Jews. And that's always usually where Paul would go first, right? He'd go to the synagogue, then he'd go to the marketplace, and then he would figure out where to go from there. But that was where a lot of believers were coming from.
Another big feature is resurrection from the dead witnessed by hundreds.
Yep, resurrection from the dead witnessed by hundreds. To the point where when Peter and Paul, when are writing, it seems like at times we could summarize or paraphrase them as saying, if you don't want to take our word for it, that's fine. Just go to Jerusalem and ask for others. And they don't say, and I take this as fairly compelling, they don't say, go to Jerusalem to this house and ask for this man who lives in this part of town, right? They don't load it and say, here's the guy you need to talk to. I've got an inside source. They say, go to Jerusalem and ask, which seems like, if you went, what? Where's the reference to that? I'll have to look that up. No, that's good. Okay, yeah, that's good. Do you know the exact reference for that? Okay, if you look it up. But what, Luke 22? Okay, so. And what they seem to be saying is that you could go, and that by going to Jerusalem and saying, I'm looking for someone who saw Jesus raised from the dead or something like that, that you would, it was a common enough thing that you could run into someone who could point you to someone, right? That's the gist of it, because it's not any more loaded than that. You're not given anything other than go to Jerusalem and ask. Others, right. Others were raised.
Again, witnessed by.
Yep. Yeah, a lot of the stories, you could have, so legend is sometimes what someone will say. One of the more common objections, and we'll talk more about this kind of thing, or we'll kind of think through how we would interact around this in the coming weeks. But legend is one of the ways, whether they say that or not, one of the common objections that's going to come up. Either Jesus didn't exist, that's a very fringe view, or, okay, yeah, he was a good kind of person, he was a moral teacher, and then they added all this stuff about him to turn him into a god and whatever and get people to start a new religion. Well, you can do that. You can elaborate, you can add things, stories can grow, and that's not uncommon. We can historically, often like historians can go back and peel back and figure out what are those things that were added later. The problem is with Christianity, the details that seem like the ones you would add, right, that make him unique, that make it what it is, that make him equivalent with God, they're added way too early for them to fit, because they're added within the lifetime of many, many, many of the eyewitnesses of the events. So you can't add false details to a story when many of the eyewitnesses are alive and still sell it and there's no questioning of it. The only way you could do that is maybe a couple hundred years later, when it's just stories of stories of stories, and now we could start to elaborate and add some details in, and we might be able to get away with it. But this is happening within 10, 15 years of the resurrection. And like they say, take the creed in 1 Corinthians 15, when Paul says, I pass on to you that which I also received, that Christ was crucified for the forgiveness of sin according to the scriptures, was buried, was raised, was seen, appeared to the 12, and then to hundreds of believers, or to hundreds at one time, and then to James, and then to me as one untimely born. And so that creed, so taking off the part where Paul talks about himself, the earlier part of that is pretty well accepted as one of the earliest, if not the earliest, Christian creed. And even skeptical historians, like I think Bart Ehrman, who's not a friend, but was an agnostic, I think he's recently come out as being atheist, will defend the historicity of the existence of Jesus, for sure, very vehemently. But he'll put that creed within a year and a half, maybe even within a year of the resurrection, supposed the resurrection of Jesus. Now, what I can't square is how you could believe that that creed is from that early and think that Jesus didn't actually rise from the dead, because how do you have that going around? It would be so easy to disprove. But they seem to be able to create these historical things pretty immediately after, which tells us they probably happened. That's the best explanation. It's certainly the most reasonable explanation by far. There's no alternative that can make sense out of those facts. There are alternatives that are not absurd in a little bit different context. Most of the alternatives don't work even moderately well given the context, but they certainly aren't the best explanation. Even if we were going to say leave a little bit of room for them to maybe they made it up. Okay, well, there's a lot of problems with that. There's a lot of challenges that would come. The most reasonable explanation by far, and one that I think is enough that I would say it's historically certain, is that he actually was raised. It's just that seems crazy because people don't rise from the dead, which it's like, well, yeah, that's the point. Secular sources, or yeah, we could call them secular. Right. So yeah, so not only do we have the writings of the apostles, and remember, for the sake of what we're doing here, and when we're talking to someone who's not a Christian, we're not treating these, now, hear me properly, hear the whole thing I'm saying here. We're not treating these as, this is the word of God, it's true, so let me tell you what it says, right? I think it is, but we have to think where they're coming from, and starting with, well, this is the word of God, you have to believe it, is not a good starting point, because that's the whole thing they're trying to analyze. Should I believe this? And so we have to be thinking more so, how could we show this is genuinely from God? How could we show, first, it's genuinely historically accurate, then that we can actually believe what they said, and then that what this entails is that it's the word of God. That comes at the end. We're establishing that. We're not starting there. Now, we may be there, and we are, I think, right in that. But we can't assume someone else is there when we talk to them, because they're not there, and that's okay. And here's what I would do to challenge. There is one strand of thinking that sort of says that's the only way you can go about it. But think about if you have a Mormon at your door, and they just tell you, well, no, the Book of Mormon is from God. It's another testament of Jesus Christ, and it's Joseph Smith's miracle. You need to believe it. You're not just going to go, oh, well, if it's the Word of God, well, of course, you know. We would never do that, but sometimes we approach non-Christians and expect them to do that with the Bible. And it's not fair of us. It's special pleading. And so we need to face the same scrutiny that we would put on them. Someone who says to you the Quran, oh, this is from God. This is the revelation of God, and it's the last and truest one. You're going to say, well, no. You know, tell me, why is that? You're not going to go, oh, well, if it's the word of God, well, of course, tell me what it says. But sometimes we approach non-Christians with that attitude. Now, that being said, I think that the Word of God is powerful, and I think it can move people. And I'm not saying we have to avoid it, but we don't go into it assuming that they just need to accept it's the Word of God because we say so, or because it's really old, or because it talks about God, right? We need to know why is that. We need to be prepared. Now, some people aren't going to really have those questions. Some people are going to just want to know what it says, and that's okay. We don't have to go back, or we don't have to start by laying that foundation. I'm still going to sprinkle a little bit of it in because I want to make clear that this is being established on something that really happened outside of me. This is not my personal. And so I'm always going to include a little bit, but I'm just more inclined that way. But we don't have to go in depth on all that if what they want to know is just what it teaches and come to faith and trust in it. But even if someone starts there, I still think we're always going to be better off laying that historically grounded foundation, laying why is it that we think Jesus is unique, and really establishing that in them so that it's not based on, well, they were really needing something to help them at that phase of life, and so they accepted Christ. I think that happens, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. You don't want to leave someone there, because now what happens when, okay, now my life's improving and Jesus is really helping me and everything's great, and then now what if something else bad happens? But we didn't ground them in anything else. All it was, well, I think it's true because look at what's happening in my life and how much better I feel. Well, what happens when they don't feel better anymore? Did God abandon them? And there are people who've run into that, and I know that story. I've heard that story. So we want to kind of meet the person where they're at. That's what we're trying to say in all that we're doing. We're asking questions, and we'll get into this when we do the interactives in the later weeks. But we're trying to figure out, who is this person? What's their background? What are their challenges, their hang-ups with regards to Christianity, their understandings, their misunderstandings? Dealing with those and then giving that person what they need. And sometimes it'll just mean they just need the gospel, or they just need what the Bible teaches on certain things. Sometimes it might mean a long process of, how do you even know God exists? And how do you know this? And why would you believe that? And that Bible's been changed hundreds of times. Well, actually, you know, that's a common view, but it actually has it. And we go back. So we don't need to do that for everyone, but we need to be approaching people in a way where we don't assume that they have to believe what we do just because we believe it. And so that means doing this. Okay, so one question that will come up is they'll say, and I'll ask you this, has anybody else other than Jesus, or you'd say the apostles, died for a religion? Can anyone think of any examples where somebody died for a religious belief? Suicide bombers, right? 9/11. So this will be and this is one that I think Christians can even have trouble with, because we have to really, once you see it, you kind of go, oh, well, that's obvious. That makes a lot of sense. But until you do, it can actually seem kind of tricky. So the 9/11 bombers died for their beliefs. So you could say, well, so what? So some of the apostles, or maybe even all of them, or most of them, died saying that Jesus rose from the dead. Well, big deal. Lots of people have died for their religious beliefs. So let's look at the 9/11 bombers and the apostles as our example. What is the difference or differences between the 9/11 bombers and the apostles? Both died for their faith, for their belief, for their religious beliefs, but what are the differences? Sure, right. So there's one, right. They were killed, the apostles were killed for what they were teaching and not actively going out and doing something that got them killed. Okay, so one was trying to bring truth and life, and one was trying to instill fear and death, right? But we could maybe think of counterexamples. Could we think of, we don't have to necessarily even put one out there, but can we think of, has there ever been a point in history where somebody died for teaching a kind, healthy-ish religious belief where they were trying to bring peace? Let's just say that.
Some argue that Joseph Smith,
right?
Died.
They'll say that he was died a martyr, right?
Yeah.
If you know the historical context of that, that's not quite so much the case. He was causing quite a bit of problems and had been raising up little gangs as well. In a jail, a mob came to the jail and a shot, I think, went through they shot through the window or through something and through the door and killed him. But there's a lot around that historical context of things that were going on. He was rallying his own sort of, not army is maybe too strong of a word, but there were rising tensions, and a lot of people were not liking Joseph Smith and the Mormons. He was causing a lot of problems. They were not liking what he was teaching, problems with how he was taking women to be his wives. He created a lot of enemy because he would take a guy's wife for his own, and then that caused bad blood, and then there were things that they were teaching. So they were getting driven from place to place. Often because they were causing problems. So, but yeah, we could think, well, we could think of other examples where someone dies for, they're trying to bring peace and they're killed. But there's still distinction in that. What's the biggest difference between the big question, I guess I'd say this way, is, okay, so both the 9/11 bombers, like, we don't have any reason to doubt they believed Islam, right? That they think it's true. We don't have any reason to doubt the apostles believe Christianity is true, that Jesus was raised from the dead. What's the difference in the basis on why the 9/11 bombers believed that Islam is true and why the apostles believed that what we know as Christianity was true? Yeah, not just closer to the source. They were the source, right? They were the source. Where the 9/11 bombers are going on teachings much, you know, much, much later in history. Now, I'm not saying that's illegitimate, right? There are Christians today being martyred for their faith, and we're going to stand behind them, and we're going to applaud them, and we're moved by that. And that happens, and it's genuine. The difference is that with the apostles, they're the actual source of the origination of the claims. So while the 9/11 bombers believed that Islam was true, the apostles knew whether or not Christianity was true, knew whether or not Jesus rose from the dead. They were the ones who started it. So if it wasn't true, then they knew it and they were lying. And not one of them recanted, right? So, and not only did they not recant at the point of death, but they sort of lost status in life. They seemingly lost what we would consider any sort of wealth, or they were maybe even or often rejected by family. So they're losing family status. There's a really funny video I thought about playing, and I don't know, maybe if we have a lot of time at the end, we can do it. But there's a, I think, amusing. Other people, it's satire, so if you don't like satire, maybe not as much, but it's kind of this silly video that was made by a guy that runs a YouTube channel called Lutheran Satire, and so he has one called Super True Stories Best Conspiracy Ever, and it's Peter and Paul collaborating. He says it's what really happened and how they came up with Christianity, and it's, of course, satirically showing, okay, it has to be true, but they're collaborating on how they're going to make up this new religion based off this life of Jesus, and goes through and says, okay, we're going to teach that Jesus rose from the dead. And so then the Paul character says, okay, so then we're going to say that if they believe it too, then they can raise from the dead as long as they give us lots and lots of money. And the Paul character says, no, we're not going to get rich. And the Peter character says, okay, well, am I at least going to get a lot of chicks or something? So it's satire, right? So they're, and he says, no, in fact, you're going to leave your job and your family and everyone's going to hate you and do all these things, and then they're going to despise you, and then they're going to crucify you upside down. And then I'm going to, you know, start off as a Pharisee, and then I'm going to give up my rock star status, and I'm going to go, and people are going to beat me and throw rocks at my head, and I'm going to be shipwrecked, go through all this stuff, and then I'm going to be killed too. And then there's a silence, and he goes, oh, yeah, and we're going to need to find like 11 other guys to do the same thing. And it just shows the absurdity of, there's no way these people knew it was not true, but did it, because there has to be some sort of benefit to make something like that up. An emotional benefit, a physical benefit, often many, especially something that severe. So you could see if they were angling to get into power. And this is something that we need to be aware of. Many people will think that the apostles, they just think Roman Catholic Church, whether they're Catholic or not, this is often a common conception from nominal Christians that leave, maybe even nominal Christians who stay, and people who've never been and have rejected it and have a lot of problem with it. They think apostles or the people who started Christianity, and they think living at the Vatican, having power, having political control, that's what they get in their head. And so you have to make sure and feel that out, because they may not have any idea what the lives of the apostles were like. And so they may think, well, yeah, they made it up because that way they got rich and powerful and all this. And when we were in Italy, we were talking with students, and that was what they said, something that was their kind of prevailing theory was, well, they just wanted the power because they think Peter was the first pope, and here's what the pope is, and he's got all this money and all this power and control, and that's what it's all about. It's like, have you ever read about the lives of the apostles? Well, no. Okay, well, let me tell you what it was actually like, and I can show you where you can go find this for yourself, too. Don't take my word for it. And so, yeah, they kind of gave up everything we would consider worthy of maybe selling a lie or twisting something or whatever. Or you could even see someone enduring a season of suffering to kind of get to that where, okay, but you can see they're establishing, right? We could say Muhammad was sort of suffering at the beginning as he's getting control, but then once he gets the army and he has enough power, then what's he do? He goes and just starts slaying anyone who won't follow him and gets wealthy and starts to get women. Joseph Smith, same thing, starts growing in power and control. All of a sudden, God's giving revelation that he needs multiple wives, and then there's only supposed to be a limited number for most of the guys, but then God tells him specially, oh, you're supposed to have this one and this one and this one. Muhammad, the same thing, keeps adding to Muhammad's number. Right, so those are things we can look at. And I'm not saying automatically it's false because of that. Those are just the kinds of things you expect to see when it's human operating on their own or under unhealthy spiritual influence. You don't expect someone to give everything up, to suffer, to be cut off, to be separated, and then to die for a lie. And you definitely... it's going to be almost impossible to get 12 people to do that. And really, more than that, because there were many early Christians dying who claimed that they saw Jesus resurrected. So you've got to have a lot of people that are selling this lie. So the prevailing alternative theory started to become something more like, okay, it was hallucination. They weren't lying. They really saw it, but it was hallucination. The problem is you have multiple instances where he's seen over a long period of time by many different people. And can you guys think of one of the people that we count on a lot for what we know of Christianity that it would have not been so compelling, especially the idea of hallucination would not have been compelling, that they would not have been lamenting and weeping and sad that Jesus is gone, and so they had some sort of vision and then they start teaching it. Can you guys think of an example? One of the apostles, one of the people we rely on a lot, that does not fit in that mold, that was not weeping or sad that Jesus was gone. Paul. Paul, exactly. So even if, now, and I'm not saying it's credible on the rest of them, but even if you had that to try and explain the rest of them, Paul is a complete anomaly to that idea. Because not only was he not lamenting, he was going and trying to stop the spread of Christianity, right? So some would say, oh, well, then he felt guilty. I've seen this. It's not at all reasonable or plausible that he felt guilty and then he had this experience and then he was radically changed. Okay?
Was he being sponsored by the Sanhedrin or anything?
Yeah, well, he was a member of the Sanhedrin, and he was the one who had gotten, he was sort of carrying out, because the way I understand it is they wanted to stop this Christian thing, but they didn't. He was the most zealous about stopping it. And so they said, you go for it, Paul. You go deal with that and get your hands dirty.
He went to Damascus armed with letters, but I'm sure that he had financial support and all political support and all the other stuff that it would take to equip him to go track down and catch or kill.
Right. Jail or execute as needed the Christians, right? And so that's what he's doing. And he has this radical... compensate for his trouble. That's what his job. I mean, he was a full time. He was a Pharisee. So that's what he did full time. He was a teacher and was a member of the Sanhedrin. So that's what he did. So there's no, that's, even if you could say, okay, well, Peter, you know, Peter's a real emotional guy. He was just really sad, and he was lamenting so badly that Jesus was gone that they were in the room, the upper room, and all of a sudden he saw a vision and then went and started a religion. One, we could discredit even that. But even if we would grant that and say, you know, maybe that works for Peter and for James because it was his brother, even though he didn't believe he was God, you know, maybe he was lamenting him enough that he was gone. Okay, you could maybe at least plausibly go that way. It doesn't hold up to scrutiny, but you could go that way. Paul is a complete anomaly of that. It doesn't work. Okay, so now, because you have, remember, not just one time. It's not that they were all in one room and claimed to have seen him. It's many times over many days in many different places and many different people and many different contexts. And so it's not how hallucination works. There can be hallucination, even group hallucination, say after a funeral, a family is weeping a lost one, and they can sort of have a group and they become convinced that there was this group vision or this group thing that happened. To start a religion off of that and to go into the depth is another thing, and there's a lot that would have to be established there. But again, Paul is going to be the anomaly to that because he wasn't weeping. He was trying to stop it, and then he has this Damascus Road experience. And the thing about Paul that I think is, while he says he was the greatest of sinners, and I'm sure he genuinely means that, he was zealous for God, so zealous that he was going to crush this false teaching because it was bad for people, right? So it wasn't out of wicked malice that he was trying to stop it. It was out of a zealousness for the truth of God that he was going to stop this false teaching because they were teaching that Jesus was God and there's one God, you know, Yah is one. And so he was going to crush this false teaching out of a zealousness for God. And I take it that that's why he's so responsive, not just because Jesus appeared to him, but because his heart was in the right place, kind of, that he was so zealous to serve God that once he recognizes without a doubt Jesus is God, then there it is. Okay, well, tell me what to do. And then he goes and he's willing to give up all of that that he'd established. And then he even says that all of these things, and when he talks about how everything he had, he counts it all as rubbish to have Christ, right? So there was something that happened that you have to explain that. And the most likely explanation is that it actually happened.
And it wasn't 72 virgins. Don't you marvel that all of the rewards for most of these other religions, and Islam is just the most prominent,
right?
All of the rewards are earthly, fleshly,
right, desires. Yep.
In heaven, in paradise.
Right, right. Yep, yeah, that's one of the things. So what Ken's bringing up is that in a lot of other religions, pretty much most of them, the rewards are earthly or more fleshly, where it's not as much, it's certainly not to the degree of virgins, and, you know, it's not Mormonism where you have your spirit wives and you make spirit babies and you start your own planet and then you're the king over that planet. It's not Islam where you have 72 virgins that will be waiting for you. It's not those types of things, right? And so that tells us something. I think that's worth drawing a distinction. And that's something we can bring up. The big thing we have with Christianity is, look, there's no way these guys could have made it up and endured all that they did. So we have not only, we know what they said, that we have what they said. It's been passed through history. And I know we just briefly covered that. We can get documentation. I can get you more in-depth stuff on that. But we need to establish that. Now we know, okay, well, so we have their eyewitness testimony. Do we believe them? Well, it's really hard to find a way why we would disbelieve them. I can't really see anything that would make sense out of it other than they all actually saw Jesus raised from the dead. It's the only way we can make any sense out of it. Okay? So now at that point, now we're getting to Christianity being true. So it's not true because the documents were passed through history well. It's true if they were passed through well and what they said was actually verified, which I think we have good reason to believe it is. Again, you have many people who are having radical or drastic, not for the positive in an earthly sense, changes to their life, that they're enduring persecution, they're enduring beatings, they're enduring death even. And none of them are recanting. None of them are saying it wasn't true. We made it up. Okay? So, let's see what else did I have there. Anything else or any points you want to add? I guess we have about 9 minutes, 8 minutes. Yeah, so again, going back to the how many of these, it is probably more of an art than a science, and it is something that you're going to be asking God for wisdom and trusting the Spirit to lead. But if the person's sincere, or if it's their hang up where you're not going to go any further unless you address it, then I'm generally going to address it. Now, if it's they don't even consider what you say, as soon as you have an answer, then it's another one, and they're not even processing on it, that's where I think you can get into it's not sincere. And then you would, and then I would ask that and just say, you know, it doesn't even seem like you're listening. You're just coming up with a new objection. You know, are you even interested in knowing that this is true? But I'm not going to start there. We don't want to question people's sort of integrity from the beginning. We want to treat them as sincere until proven otherwise. And so it's going to be just a matter of interaction and experience and learning and kind of having some questions that you generally ask. And as we, for me, it's not hard to get to this, not only because, you know, I know it and I've studied it, but also when you are leaning primarily on trying to show someone that Jesus really is who he claimed to be and that Christianity is actually true and that's why it matters, and not on your own experience, you're going to end up in this kind of conversation more. If you're using your testimony just to point to, but what matters and why I think my testimony or why I think God can do this is because it's actually real. Jesus actually taught what he did. He actually was crucified and he rose from the dead. And I know that seems odd, and it certainly is. It's not the kind of thing that happened, but I think it's it really happened in history. If you're presenting it more that way, then you're going to have that kind of conversation a lot more. I think the way that generally Christians have, whether they've been taught or it's just been sort of picked up, the way that we have done what you could call evangelism, where it's been so based on your personal testimony. Again, not saying it's irrelevant, but when that's your primary basis, you're not going to get in a discussion about this because the grounds, and this is why I have a problem with only doing that, the ground you're giving them to believe in Jesus is your testimony. So it's not surprising we don't get in a talk about, well, how could you know Jesus was rose from the dead or whatever? Because we're telling them, no, I'm the reason you believe Jesus. This happened to me. You have to believe me. My life was changed. Jesus can change your life too.
Yeah, well, that may be true for you.
Well, and it may be true. It may be true that your life was changed because of Jesus, and it may be true that Jesus could change their life too, but the basis of that is not because your life was changed, it's because he actually is God, and because he actually came and did these things and died for sin and rose from the dead. That's why it has power. Right.
Say, you know, do you believe in George Washington? Do you believe that he really existed?
Right.
How do you believe that?
Right.
Is that helpful?
So, yeah. So for the recording, Paul's asking, do we start or have I ever started with trying to establish some other historical figure, George Washington or something like that, and trying to. I personally don't start. I'll do that if they're questioning and saying, well, there's no way to know Jesus was real, whatever. And often what's going to be behind this, and this is another principle of the file away, this is a really important one. What, because of how science, and specifically mathematically based science, has become the purveyor of truth. That is how we find truth, right, today. Scientism. Whether or not someone explicitly and intentionally holds to it, or sort of implicitly and maybe even unintentionally, it will be a common view today that in order for something to be true, it has to be scientific or mathematically proven. And so what will happen is that we put the standards of mathematical truth on everything, or scientific truth on everything. And so they'll think, well, you can't prove. How could you possibly prove? And what they mean by prove is scientifically or mathematically prove that Jesus rose from the dead. What we need to be able to say is, well, that's not a scientific claim. It's a historical one. So we need to be able to establish that it's historically true, not mathematically true. Or something like the existence of God. That's not a question of science. It's necessarily outside the realm of science, because science is the study of natural things in the physical world. We're saying God is not physical, and he's outside the natural physical world, right? So necessarily, it's not a scientific claim. It's a philosophical one. So I don't need to be scientifically certain God exists. I need to be philosophically certain. And there's going to be different criteria, different standards. And so that's often what will be behind this question when they start to, if somebody starts to push, they're going to say, well, that's ridiculous. That could never happen. Or how could you ever know that was, Jesus was even real? Because, and often, again, what they're going to have in their head is, you couldn't scientifically, you can't taste it or smell it or touch it or, well, yeah, because it's history. That's not what you do with history.
I'm sorry, I'm a 20th century guy. This is great, but I've lost sight of why they should even care, since what we know of the 21st century in America is
okay.
Pretty darn good.
Okay, right.
Why are they even talking to us?
So that's next week. Why does it matter? That's our question for next week. So, which we need to know.
Some would have started with that, but I didn't.
Sure, that's okay.
So if somebody is somewhat interested in listening to you when you start and sort of interested in hearing about your story, how do you get past the fact that you're trying to sell them something and all this stuff is so far removed, it's thousands of years ago, you're bringing up people I've never heard of, like Peter and Paul.
Right.
And you're telling me so many things, my mind's just going crazy.
Yeah.
You're trying to win me, so you're going to tell me, and I know there's other people that disagree with you.
Right.
Okay,
so the question is essentially, how do we get past someone maybe being overloaded with so much information and that there's all these competing claims and they know that we're trying to sell them something? Well, so one, we want to, while we don't need to hide from the fact that we think it's true and we want people to believe it, we need to be approaching people in a way where they don't feel like we're just trying to sell them, right? Where, hey, I just genuinely care. I think this is true and that it matters. And I care about you. Why do you care about me? Well, because you're a person. You're made in God's image. Well, that's it? That's why you care? You know, so if we're approaching it with that, where there's something about you that there's a sort of different, or at least is favorable, and we're not trying to just beat people over the head with it, and, you know, you're an idiot if you don't believe this, then I think that's going to open things up. And we don't want to overwhelm them. So I'm going to be talking about a lot here, and we'll have interactions, and you guys will bring up things that... But we're not trying to say, okay, dump all of this on someone. What we're going to do, and hopefully this will come out when we can get to the interactive and we think of scenarios, and I'll have different scenarios we'll make up and how would we approach it, is we want to ask questions to find out what are the most significant things for this person. And we want to start with addressing those and then build from there. And so hopefully we're not overloading them too much, although that might still happen. And so then it's just figuring out and asking a lot of questions. So something like, you know, well, if this really happened, would you care? If I could show you that it was historical, that Jesus really did, would you be interested then? I'm not saying if you just believe me or if you just blindly, but if I could actually show you that we have historical reason to believe, just like, and then that might be something. So then, would that, okay, tell me about your background. There might be something back there that's why they're so, no, that's not going to matter. Because you think about that. It's like saying, if I could prove to you that you have a heart condition, that if you don't start taking this medication, you're going to die in a week, would you care? Well, of course, right? I mean, that's crazy if they would say, no, that's irrelevant. I don't want to know. When all they'd have to do is take this medication, they'd be better. And so kind of in the same way, if you're showing them and you're not doing it in a threatening way and you're not doing it in a you're an idiot if you don't or whatever, but just, hey, I understand it's reasonable to have a basis to believe something. And so if I could show you that, would you be interested? Some of those kind of questions are going to help. That's okay. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Okay. That it was just for religion? Yeah, so I think... Yeah. So political and religious, it mixes, especially with Islam. His question was, did I think 9/11 was just for religion and that's it? So with Islam, it's really tricky because religion and politics, there's no separation for the most part. Now you'll have moderate to liberal Muslims that will say, oh, no, it doesn't necessarily. But you look anywhere Islam has control and it's completely married with politics. There's no separating it. So it's going to be hard to separate those two completely, right, ever. And certainly I think there are political motivations, but also religious ones. But the religious ones are the grounds on which you convince someone to fly a plane into a building because they're going to go straight to heaven. They're going to, you know, that is probably the grounds on which they were moved to say, I'm going to lose my life for this. Now, there were political motivations behind why would somebody tell this guy, hey, go fly this plane into the building. But the religious ones are why he would be willing to do it. Most likely. Those were the primary factors anyways. And so when we're looking at the apostles, the beginning of Christianity, we're saying, well, why would they do it? And what is the basis? And it is a religious, we could say, motivation. They're dying because they're not going to deny that Jesus rose from the dead, that he is the Christ, that he is the Messiah, that he has equality with God in some way. They're not going to deny that. The difference is the 9/11 bombers, they're just taking it off of religious teaching down the line, and they're way up here, way further past the foundation of that teaching, and they're dying for it. Muhammad didn't die, well, at least not early on. He didn't die because of what he was teaching. In fact, he gained and he killed, and he gained power because of what he was teaching, where the apostles are the equivalent to Muhammad in the Christian story, in that they're the ones who founded it, they originated it, yet they're the ones who suffer and die. You don't find other religions, for the most part, where the founders, who know whether or not it's true, who have the things, suffer and die and lose. They usually gain influence, gain power, gain wealth, gain women, and then somewhere down the line, others are starting to be asked, hey, you need to die for this thing because it can give you something. But the founders rarely ever have that happen. You might be able to find some in the more the wisdom teachings, something where you might be able to find more isolated founders of more something more like along the lines of a Buddhism where they might be killed for going against whatever the trend is. But they're not dying for an eyewitness saying, hey, I saw this thing happen. Who did? Yeah. Yeah. So what he's bringing up is that there were some early Christians who did recant in order to save their lives, and so that it's got to be a heart-level conviction, not just a head thing. I would say, like, yes, that's probably the case, but it could be even more. I mean, I'm not going to say I would necessarily, I would hope I would stand up under that, but I'm not saying that even it would necessarily be a problem for some of those early Christians. And then the other thing is, too, not all the early Christians who died were eyewitnesses of the resurrection. There were some who were, some who weren't, that were martyred later on. But that you would get so many people who were the founders of it, that's the main distinction I'm driving at, is you could show a lot of early Christians who denied it, and you haven't disproven Christianity because you still have the apostles. And that's what's most compelling, is that the apostles who saw it and started teaching and started converting others did not deny it. And I would even say, let's say you even had one, to have even a handful of people be willing to face everything they face and die is quite compelling. To have all of them is, you know, overwhelming evidence to me historically. Yes.
Whether you look at the Crusades or you look at a lot of what we try to do here, even in America, where
right.
We vote in our people that believe our things so they can change the laws the way they
Right.
As opposed to reaching people with the gospel, each and every one of us. I think we got to be...
Yeah, there can be a danger.
We have to be honest enough with ourselves that there's not a draw to... And even going back as far as Constantine with the connection of...
Right.
Of Christendom with the power of...
Right.
The politics.
Yeah, perhaps the best and worst thing that happened.
We're not similar to
that. Yeah, we can all be prone to that. I agree. I think with Islam, it's unique in that it's almost inseparable. Where Christianity at times has dabbled or dove deep in, but it's not inseparable. It's easy to see how it's separated. Where with Islam, it's almost inseparable. That's just a distinction. That's not a critique of what you're saying. I just think there is still a distinction that does come, and that's why we can resist it and why we need to not put all of our hope in government, because it's clearly not where our hope should be grounded as Christians.
Among Christians that I relate to,
mm-hmm.
There seems to be a dichotomy of believers who are politically interested and
right.
who want
political power.
We'll speak for
right.
politically active.
Right. Right, they're completely separate. Right.
With politics.
So we probably want to avoid either of the extremes. Is that what you're getting?
I'm expressing that as what I'm experiencing, and probably I'd like to know how to avoid the extremes, or at least how to
right.
identify the extremes.
And
I push myself in that continuum.
Right, so trying to figure out, so the question, probably a discussion for another day, because I think we're already a little over, but is how do we find that balance between not completely abandoning any sort of politics, oh, we have nothing to do with that, that's for, you know, the other people, and then going to the other extreme of, okay, that's where our hope is, we have to get a Christian government in, and, you know, all the Christians, and then everything's going to be great. How do we find the balance between those two, where we don't abandon it, we do our responsibility, but we also don't put our trust in it? So probably a discussion for another day, but a very good question. There was one more that we'll take, and then we'll try to wrap up. Okay, very good. So again, just quick summary. Last week we talked about where is it from, what's the source, where did you hear that, and established that, okay, we know that we have, with high degree of certainty, almost exactly what they wrote 2,000 years ago. Today the question was, well, how do we know we can believe it now that we know we have it? And so that's where we're talking about why we believe the eyewitness testimony of the apostles, and that's really the foundation of Christianity, believing their eyewitness testimony that they suffered pretty immensely and even died teaching that Jesus rose from the dead. And we don't have good reason to there's no good critical analysis of that or that would say why it's false. So we know we have the Bible, passed through history well, and we know that what they wrote, we have good reason to believe actually happened because of the embarrassing details, because of the things that they were willing to suffer, because of the things that they taught, and the only way that they could have caught at the time was if they were actually true, it seems like. And so we have good reason. So then next week, we move into the discussion of, well, what does it matter, right? So now, I mean, part of it is obvious, it matters if it's true, but helping to think through how do we talk to the world about why does it matter and that they should even listen to these other things. So, very good? All right. Thanks, guys.